W-H-U-R-Y-Y, K-Q-R-I-W on the TechNet.
That is correct, it's correct. They just taped the last launch and went up, and I watched it this time just to take a good look at it. And that's what it shows. As the picture gets a little, you keep in mind, effect, you don't see the same. It'll clear up like you saw one side like another. And that seems to make a lot of sense. So, okay, so the analog thing sort of made me wonder a little bit. I thought everything was digital nowadays. The world was going here, going there. But I didn't realize that you could still use FM modulation.
Dick, I have a message for you, WH2CDL.
They got a couple of minutes dropout.
Okay. I'm listening to both the input and the output. And by the way, Joe, at my house, you're considerably louder on the input than you are through the repeater. I heard WS2N and WA2CDL, I think in that order. No, I heard WA2CDL first. Andy, go ahead and make your comment, and then we'll pick up with Paul right after you. WA2CDL, K2RIW.
Yeah, good evening. I just got in the car. I didn't get a chance to get on earlier. Just a message, because I haven't been listening. The power amp at the East repeater, Selden, went out, and Eric's got it in his possession. So I can't hear the repeater where I am. It may be up or maybe down. He put it on the exciter, but the exciter's only running about 100 milliwatts of power into the duplexer. So I'm not sure what the coverage is right now, and it may be down because of the coverage that would be poor. So just to let you know for the net tonight, Dick, back to you.
Yeah, but I think what you're saying is that a person who tries to get in by way of the eastern input, 147.375, the output's going to be noisy because it's down to 100 milliwatts. But is that part of the link that gets us into this western repeater? I thought that link was done by a internet connection. And so if Joe was going in the eastern input, wouldn't he be coming? Oh, wait a minute now. He did say that the internet connection is not enabled at this time. Back to you for any comments on that one, Andy.
Yeah, that's right. Someone can still go into the eastern input and come out on this repeater. But this signal coming back from the eastern input, and that was a little bit confusing, it will be weaker if he's on the fringe because the power's a lot less. But it's possible because of that they disconnected, and I don't know if Eric did it, turned off the link to prevent any possible confusion because if someone's listening back from someone getting into this repeater and he's on the fringe, he's not going to hear it. So that would be the reason why if it's down. Just to let you know.
Y-Y-Y.
Okay. Joe, sounds like Eric is going to turn on the link. Out of curiosity, Joe, do you have better access to the eastern input if that's enabled as far as the internet connection is concerned? R-Y-Y, go ahead.
Yeah, I was trying to tell you that those Glen Oaks offline. They tried dialing in the rest before, and it's offline. Let's somebody purposely took it offline.
Okay, sounds like Eric is in the process of reestablishing it. In fact, I'm going to make a quick transmission there right now.
It's going to take about a minute or two, Dick.
Roger, Roger. Then I won't make a transmission right now. Gee, just think, Eric, tonight's the night that I've been putting great big delays in there to make sure that people on the internet can get through. Tonight I was wasting my time. Last week I hear tell there was a whole bunch of people that wanted to get through, and we were so quick on the switch they couldn't do it. Okay, we'll stand by and wait till Eric is finished doing that enabling.
No, I keep talking. I'll tell you when.
Roger, Dodger. Okay, was there another person? Yeah, it was Paul. Paul, WS2N, hopefully you're coming into the western machine until the east one's enabled. Go ahead with your comment, Paul, on how all this beautiful video is coming out of NASA Select. WS2N, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, yeah, no, early on I noticed the Selden was... Yeah, I wasn't copying anything on my HT, so I knew the at least the transmission part of that was down. So yeah, this evening I've been going through Western link, and all I wanted to say was that yeah, there's always about a 4-minute dropout, just shy of 4 minutes over India, where they're picking up the difference between the two Tejas satellites. And they do have there is a fourth one up there, Tejas satellite, but that's like a standby in case one fails. They've been around a long time. In fact, one of them was supposed to have been put up by Challenger. That was on board the Challenger when that thing blew up. A lot of people don't realize that. So, okay, Dick. That's all I wanted to make a comment. I've heard the same thing about the KU band. I don't know if it's digital. I assume it is. I don't know. When it drops out, it definitely looks analog. You know, it doesn't pixelate. I don't know what that means. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, the actual format of the digital transmission in KU band uplink between Space Shuttle and Tejas satellite, TDRSS, which I think stands for Tracking Data Relay Satellite System. That is a earlier format of digital NASA select type television. I do remember reading a manual describing the formatting of it way back in the late 70s, early 80s, I think it was. So the digital television of today is two or three generations downrange from that one. A lot of water under the bridge since then on the way the current digital television system with all of its multiplexing capability has been designed, established, developed, call it what you like, very, very different. So the fact that it doesn't pixelate like a modern-day digital television doesn't surprise me, even though it might be a digital uplink. Let's see if Eric has got that link running. If so, I'll be able to switch in such a way.
Go ahead, try transmitting on 375.
I just tried flipping over to 375. I think I heard Joe in there. Joe, I'm going to give you enough of a delay and repeat your message. I think you were coming through the 375 a lot better. To B2RYY, I think it was, K2RYW.
Well, I see the problem. The problem is this machine is not connected. Hang on. K2RW, K2EJ.
K2EJ, K2RW.
Yeah, it looks like the internet service at 2VL has a problem.
Okay. So, this is the week when I was going to give lots of delays so people could sign in, and it looks like they're not going to be able to. So, they can go to all the IRLP or whatever nodes they want, and I think you're saying they have essentially no connectivity to this machine. Is that true, Eric?
Yeah, actually, it seems like there are folks in Las Vegas and California are connected to the reflector, but they're not hearing us. I'm just going to try another IP address and see if the broadcast station that we share the internet service with has the same problem. So, give me a minute.
Okay, we'll keep talking. Paul, now is as good a time as any for you to give us the space report, because I think... Let me stand by for a second. Did I skip anyone who signed in who did have a question earlier? If so, give me your call letters right now. Okay, there being none, why don't you give us your space report right now, Paul, and or your question I think you had. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
All right. I didn't have a question, in the beginning, so I just had a little space report, not much. Anybody following STS-119, the Space Shuttle Discovery, of course, they could always get their immediate updates from the NASA website, www.nasa.gov. But there are a couple of things on there that are interesting that they do. Of course, the solar panels, the final set of solar panels have been installed. Now, they have four sets. It's taken four individual flights of shuttles to the space station to install those four sets of panels, not to mention all the other parts and habitats and everything they put up there. 30 odd flights, it's about 35, 36 flights I think now to the space station with the shuttle. They've done a couple of interesting things on the traffic. You know, besides the thrilling part of installing this gigantic truss section, the S6 truss section, final segment of the space shuttle, they do have a node to go up later this year, another node. A node is like a six-sided device. You could float around inside of space. And that's what it, you know, connects all these different modules and truss sections to, you know, to the to one another. You know, like a big Lego block. They have two nodes up there now, and they've Unity with the original and Harmony with another one, and the third one is going up, and that will have the ability for docking purposes, and also on top of it, you're going to have the cupola. They are going to build that. They are going to send that up probably later this year. Big lookout area for the astronauts. Right now they have a couple of small windows that they can look out to look at planet Earth when we drop it. This will enable at least two people, maybe three, to float up and look out this six-sided windows. Trapezoided in nature type of windows with a big overhead view window on top. Panels that close on the outside which with a steel in case they need to change out of glass. They seal it, you know, these panels close and seal the whole thing in. And you could actually change out of glass if you had to. Pretty neat feature. Presently they're looking for the name. They have students and everybody writing the name, and you know, they want to name the this next node in cupola lookout section that they're going to put up. But one of the things they did on the flight was you had this guy Steve Swanson and Richard Arnold, two of the astronauts that went out on a spacewalk with Travis. They're up to two spacewalks so far. They've got another one to go tomorrow. Now, Steve Swanson and Richard Arnold, first time they've tried this, they have, they're testing their gloves before and after they go out on a spacewalk. And this is in preparation for future missions when they go to Mars. They think that far ahead. They swab their gloves with these gigantic Q-tips and analyze it, and they can analyze it within 15 minutes whether or not it has any bacteria on the gloves. Now, they want to know this because two reasons. You don't want to go down and contaminate a planet, pristine area, and if there is any biological stuff down there, they don't want to bring it back in. And the way they test this is before the S6 structure went up that they installed, there were half a dozen spots along that structure that they noticed had a bacteria type reactions when you grab certain hand railings and all, that were higher than other parts of the S6 structure. So when the astronauts go out and test their palms or their gloves, they should get higher readings when they come back and drop it. And you would think, oh, okay, everything's supposed to be super sterile and everything when the stuff goes up. But that's not really the case if it's not a planned planetary landing mission, such as all the Mars missions that we've had. Those things, you know, they go through super steam cleaning type of purposes, process before you even think about sending that stuff to land on a planet. The Huygens space mission, when that landed on Saturn's moon, Titan, the processes that they go through is different than when you just send something into orbit. It came up when they sent Galileo to Jupiter when it dropped. That was never planned on landing on a moon or a planet, so they didn't go through that process. And a lot of people thought at the end of Galileo's mission, which went on for many, many years, but I think 7 or 8 years or something, before they decided to crash this thing. They said, well, let's just crash it to the moon. No, they chose to send it back to the planet Jupiter. They didn't want to land it on a moon because it never went through this sterilizing process before launch. They were afraid that if you crash landed on Europa or accidentally crash landed on one of the moons around the planet, you know, theoretically you could be contaminating that moon. Now, you know, 50 years from now, 100 years from now, astronauts land on these moons and they come up bacteria and they say, oh, life. And they'll say, no, this came from that spacecraft that we never cleansed properly before we launched it, Dick. So I thought I'd mention that. Let me drop it. And one other little thing you can see that's on the NASA site when you go onto the internet. They mentioned a 4-inch piece of, space junk from an old China booster that was in orbit coming close to the space station. So they had to reorient the whole space station and the shuttle all at one time, point the shuttle in a forward position. In case something went wrong, it would be able to launch with no problem, get away from the space station, of course, with all the everybody on board, not quite everybody, but most of the other three that are on board would leave on a Soyuz spacecraft if they had to. But they have to reorient this gigantic stack that they call it, the whole space station and the shuttle, just because of one 4-inch piece of space junk. I don't know, Dick, I don't know what you think, but there should be some kind of a mission. It would be probably very expensive and complex to go up there and capture as much space junk as they can. I mean, there's like, 20,000 pieces bigger than 2 inches floating around. But somehow catch the important ones and, I don't know, put it in the back of the shuttle and send it back home somehow. They should dedicate a mission just for something like that. It might be costly. Might have to have like 20 missions to do it, but one of these days, I think they're going to run out of luck. Back to you, Dick. WXY.
Well, yeah, the resources required to collect those pieces of space junk out of the question, out of the question. If you look how long it takes for the space shuttle to link up with the International Space Station, it's about a 3-day maneuver, as I remember, in order to get the two orbits to be coplanar, to have a common apogee and perigee, co-elliptic. It's a very complicated maneuver. You'd have to do that to capture each individual piece of space junk. It takes a lot of maneuvering power to do it. Now, if I understand you correctly, in this particular mission, STS-119, I think it is, they're doing this contamination study on the globes. And if I understand you correctly, bacteria that was intentionally left on this latest module, which has been bathed in the hard vacuum of space, and they're going to be swabbing their gloves to find out whether or not when the astronauts outside that module touch during a spacewalk, touch that spot on the outside of the module, they pick up some of the bacteria, and is that bacteria still alive, even though it's been bathed in the hard vacuum of space and the ultraviolet exposure and everything else? I'm a little bit amazed by that one. Another thing you mentioned is that Galileo, because it hasn't had a decontamination maneuver done before it was launched, that there is a possibility it's going to leave the orbit of Saturn and go back to Jupiter. I'm very skeptical of that one. I don't think there's anywhere near enough booster power on board to do that, to get out of the gravity field of Saturn, get yourself into the gravity field of Jupiter. By my standard, that's an awfully big maneuver. I may have misunderstood you on that one. That's subject number two. And subject number three, I know that the new solar cells are now a great big reflecting object, combined with the space shuttle, another reflecting object. And so there were some extremely desirable Earth views that were possible Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday of this week. I didn't get a chance to see them, but there were a number of
repeater, time out.
There were a number of emails and websites going around saying that at 7:48 at night on Tuesday, you look to the southwest, 24 degrees above the horizon. The International Space Station and the Space Shuttle will just go into the sunlight that they are seeing at their altitude, and therefore there'll be a nice bright object that will be in view on the ground. I wonder if you know of anyone who actually visually sighted them from the ground. I was going to do that Tuesday and Wednesday, but didn't get a chance to do it. So, a couple of subjects there, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Yeah, out of the dozen times or so I've gone out to look, I've never seen the space station and the shuttle go by. You're supposed to be able to see it better because they're docked together. The International Space Station keeps getting bigger and bigger. I've yet to see it. No, many, many, many millions of people have, but not me. The only thing I've seen is launch. I've seen the shuttle go downrange, separate from the external tank, and I've seen main cutoff, MECO, main engine cutoff. I've seen that once. That's my history there, Dick. There's a lot of guys on the Connecticut net, simplex that we I get on that every Thursday, and they're into that. I'll have to check Thursday to see if any of those guys saw that. Okay, let me drop it. Talk about Galileo.
Yeah, Galileo and contamination, those next two subjects. Go ahead.
Galileo, yeah. Galileo was the one in orbit around Jupiter for many, many years. The one around, that's going around right now, around Saturn, is Cassini. Yeah, somehow we got our signals crossed. Cassini is in orbit. We'll stay around orbit around Saturn for hopefully another 10 years and do science. But the Galileo spacecraft was the one that was in Jupiter, around Jupiter for many, many years, taking a picture of all their moons. And in fact, that did have a probe initially that went into the atmosphere of Jupiter. But at the end of the mission, they deorbited it 110,000 miles an hour and let it enter the Jupiter atmosphere. Of course, it doesn't make it to the surface. On Jupiter, everything burns up to nothing before it gets that far. It comes in like a meteor. So that's two separate topics there, Dick. I was talking about the craft that landed on Titan. That was the one that separated from its mothership, which is Cassini, in orbit around Saturn. And that craft was sterilized before it landed on height. So that's where the confusion set in there. And the third topic is, the gloves. What they did is, there's not bacteria on the outside. There's something else. Oh, God, I'm not far from a biologist. There's some kind of a residue or whatever that's more prone to be in certain areas on the S6 structure. Let me drop it. And the group that wanted to do this experiment scan the whole structure, and it turned out certain areas were they said six different areas that were more prone to have this reaction to their instruments. It wasn't bacteria, it was not a live thing, but whatever the substance was is, shows up on their test. They didn't put it there, it just happened to be there when they scanned the whole structure. And they knew that the three or four EVAs that they'll be doing, they'll be coming in, going out into certain areas, and when coming back in, they'll be scanned, and they can test the reaction, make sure their test equipment works properly. First time they've ever done anything like this, by the way, out of all the EVAs, moonwalks and everything that they've ever done. They never tried this. Of course, this is for future use when going to Mars. So you don't want to contaminate Mars, and if there's anything there, you don't want to bring it back. So there you go, Dick. Back to you, WS.
K2UPS.
K2UPS, go right ahead. Start over with your name, sir. My name is Dick.
How you doing, Dick? The name here is Rich, and just wanted to say that myself and a number of other hams, Dave and 2APG, Mark and 2FLF, we have all spotted the space station going over his head on numerous occasions. the good website heavensabove.com, and you can plot it. We've seen satellites and rockets from other nations all go overhead. But like I said, we spotted the space station on many occasions and pointed out to a number of my neighbors, and it's quite a sight to see.
Very fine, Rich. Did you see the really bright one that was supposed to take place Tuesday of this week? Or when was the last sighting that you and Dave did, Rich? Go ahead.
We both saw it on Tuesday, and it plots it out. It gives you the exact time it's going to come over, the direction to look, and you spot them pretty easily when they go overhead. And we did see it. It was very bright.
Yeah, Dave mailed me a bunch of information on how to do that. And when you guys were looking at your watch and looking at what you saw in the sky, was it as bright as it was supposed to be? And did the timing occur exactly the way it was supposed to, 24 degrees above the horizon, I think is where it was supposed to enter the sunlight and suddenly flash at you? Is that approximately what you saw? Rich, go ahead.
Yeah, pretty much. The times are very accurate. On occasion, you might be off by about a minute or two, but for the most part, those times are very accurate and directions are good. And the iridium flares are also quite prevalent. Good spottings on those. Follow when you type in the better location that you can type in as far as your longitude and latitude, then it'll customize a list of what's going to be visible and at what time and at what magnitude for your location.
Where were you and Dave last Tuesday, or if you were with Dave, when you sighted the shuttle and the International Space Station? Back to you, Rich.
I believe it. He was at his home, and I was at my home in Hicksville. But that's where we were watching it from, and we could see it right here. He has a lot of light pollution from by gas stations, I believe. But I'm in a residential neighborhood here, and I usually don't have any trouble spotting it when they say it's going over.
Do you think Dave did it from his home, or do you think he went to a local open field in a schoolyard or something like that? How about you, Rich?
Now, I'm not 100% sure where he was that night, but sometimes I know he will go either down by the beach or to an open area. Like I said, it is visible from most areas on Long Island when they say it will be.
Dave says from home. Okay, so in Massapequa, with those local glass stations, Dave, and yes, you saw that. Give us a few words on what you saw, Dave. N2APG, KQLIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, N2APG, good evening, Rich, Dick, and everybody else. Heavens Above, that's the place. Great website. You put in your viewing location, and then you hit the tab for ISS, International Space Station. It gives you precise predictions for your viewing location. It tells you exactly where and when to look in the sky for the space station. And it's, it's superbly bright, especially on the high passes. And by a high pass, I mean elevation. If you get a pass that's up at 75, 80 degrees above the horizon, it's usually very, very bright. And that happens almost once every night or early in the morning.
Yeah, the Tuesday night pass at around 7:50, I think we're supposed to enter our area at around due west and go to the north-northeast. I believe your house faces north. That set of station garages and whatever are on the corner to the west of you. So therefore, if you were standing in your front yard of your house, Dave, I believe you were looking directly over that gas station, so to speak, in order to see the space station on Tuesday night. Is that where you were, and was it still bright enough to be easily viewable with all your local light pollution? Tell us what you saw, Dave. N2APG, K2RIW.
The space station is very bright. Just to give you an idea, on a dim pass, when it's not very bright, it's about zero magnitude. That's a dim pass. On a good pass, when it's very bright, it's about minus two.
So that's what you saw Tuesday night, looking over the top of that gas station, so to speak?
Yeah, I don't recall if Tuesday night was as good as you know, set it up to be. But like I said, as a rule, when you look at the Heavens Above website and they give you a list of passes, visible passes for the space station, the trick is to look at the highest elevation. The passes that have the highest elevation are normally the brightest passes. And as just as a rule of thumb. But even the passes that are low and aren't that bright are still very, very nice to see, as Rich will attest to. Even the ones that aren't that bright, it's amazing to see it go by. Remember, it's traveling 18,000 miles an hour, and there's people out there.
Okay. 17,500 miles an hour, close enough to 18,000. Very good, Dave, thank you for the report. I think we've covered everyone who checked in tonight with a question. I've been doing a couple of checks with the Eastern input, and it looks like the internet connection between this machine and that machine is not operational. If it was, Eric would have come back and said, hey, start using it. So let me double check to find out if there were any further people who checked in with questions. If so, let us know about that right now. If not, we're going to go over to Mel's mailbag. So anyone with any further questions, give me your call, letters, and name right now, K2LIW. Go ahead, Eric.
No, it's a computer up at going out has an issue, so it's not happening.
Okay, so there is no internet connection tonight. Now, are there other people with a question that we've not caught up to yet? Give me your call, letters, and name right now. Okay, that was a double. I think Paul was one of them. Who was the other person?
KB1QBZ.
I heard KB1QBZ, and I think there was another double. Who was the other person?
Whiskey 2 Echo Whiskey Kilo, Eugene.
Okay, I heard Eugene and another super weak station, which I think I'm not going to be able to get. KB2QBZ, start over your name, sir, and then your question. My name is Dick.
Good evening, Dick. KB1 Quebec Bravo Zoo, the handle is John. And the question is sort of a general one in dealing with antennas. Your sense of how whether it would be possible to use the typical kind of field strength meter as a useful tool in measuring the performance of an antenna. You know, I know the old rule that SWR isn't the most important thing, and how well you're getting out is the most important thing. The typical field strength meter that's sold through HRO, whatever, are those any useful for doing those kinds of measurements?
Okay, the S meter you've got in your ordinary receiver, when you put it out and connect it to a good laboratory signal generator, particularly one that is frequency synthesized, if you try doing it with a Hewlett-Packard 608 on 2 meters, unless the signal generator had been warmed up for an hour and a half, it'll be drifting around and life will be kind of difficult. Turns out that you'll discover that the S meters are quite often at the low end of the scale between S0 and S1 and S2. You'd like them to be 6 dB, and they're about 1.5 or 2 dB of difference between the two. At around S9, they're pretty close to 6 dB. At around 10 over, they start compressing in the other direction. However, nothing stopping you from calibrating your particular S meter on your particular receiver. As long as the receiver has repeatable performance, there's nothing stopping you from building a calibration curve. What I've done on plotting antenna patterns for my VHF antennas is I calibrated my S meter by using a step attenuator in front of the receiver while somebody gave me a steady signal on 432. A guy 10 miles away aimed his antenna at me. I told him to go key down for 10 solid minutes while I ran a bunch of calibration curves. And I took the S meter reading out of my receiver with a cable out the back, connected it to a strip chart recorder, and that became the vertical axis of the strip chart recorder with the calibration curves on the graph. The horizontal axis became the voltage coming out of my HAM-M rotator. There's a potentiometer on it that goes from minus 180 to plus 180 degrees, so to speak. So I was able to calibrate my S meter, calibrate the azimuth positions by way of the potentiometer on the ham amp. And so a guy would give me a steady state signal on 432, and I would rotate the antenna and plot the antenna pattern. And it was repeatable, I believe, to the nearest dB or so. Now, because I've got a couple of water towers in the town and things like that, I repeated the experiment with a couple of other 432 guys in other directions. And there I compared the results, like
repeater, timeout.
One of my Yagi antenna pattern plots showed a funny bump on one side, and by standing up on my tower and looking that direction, I said, oh yeah, there's the Dix Hills water tower. And I was getting a reflection off that water tower, and therefore that particular side lobe on the antenna pattern became distorted. So, believe it or not, with relatively simple equipment in your backyard on a rotatable antenna, you'd be amazed how easy it is to plot the antenna pattern. Now, there have been a couple of articles in QST Magazine as to how to do this with sun noise. That's a little bit more difficult. But with a real good radiometer setup on your receiver, it is possible to wait until the sun is on the horizon, rising in the morning or setting at night, and wave your antenna across the sun, and with proper calibration, you can get an antenna pattern out of that. But having a ham friend of yours send you a signal during the calibration procedure, during the rotation and recording procedure, nowadays, you wouldn't do it with a strip shot recorder. You would take the AGC voltage of your signal strength meter, your S meter, you'd put it into a digitizing circuit, an analog to digital converter, maybe even your audio board with proper equipment could do it. That's on part of your computer. You'd let the computer record all the individual signal strength. This is antenna rotation, and then what you would do is to have the computer plot that antenna pattern for you. So making an antenna pattern out of modern-day test equipment is rather doable as I see it, John. I think that's what you're asking. If it's an antenna that you can't rotate, like the dipole in your backyard, that's a lot more difficult. Now, in theory, you can do that by letting the sun sweep across the sky and properly interpreting that noise. That's a much more difficult process. Maybe that helps a little bit. KB2, QBZ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Thank you. All right, that's very useful. I was thinking more of just a handheld field strength meter that I could move around walk around the antenna. But you've given me some ideas relative to using other people's S meters. What about the kind of handheld meters that HRO and AES sell, the handheld field strength meters? Over.
Yes, it's possible to do that. Possible to do that, and you'll get a rough approximation of the answer you're looking for, John. The problem with that is when you stand on the ground with a field strength meter, let's assume your antenna is now on the chimney of the house or on top of the tower, you're at the wrong elevation angle, and you're going to get a different antenna pattern. Rotating the antenna with a signal really coming from somebody else over the horizon, I wasn't using their S meter. I was using my S meter. They were just a source of signal. They would aim their antenna toward me, run key down for 10 minutes, while I ran a step attenuator and a calibration curve on my S meter into my strip shot recorder, and then I rotated my antenna, recorded my S meter into the strip shot recorder, and got an antenna pattern. And after doing it a couple of different times with people in different directions, I got a very accurate plot of my 19-element Yagi on 432, what the main lobe and the side lobes and everything looked like. Got a beautiful plot, which I then used to digitize that and then go to a computer program that figured out what all 16 antennas were doing when they were combined in that array. And if you've seen my red QSL card with the antenna pattern on the back, that's where that information came from. I carefully measured the pattern of one antenna, mathematically combined 16 of them in order to draw that antenna pattern that's on my QSL card. If you saw I think it was the April or May issue of CQ Magazine, 2008, May or June, April or May issue, I forget which it was, of CQ Amateur Radio, there's an article by K2RIW showing you the antenna pattern. I wonder if you saw that one. If not, somebody's got some old issues, you can see it from your library or whatever. You'll see a picture of the antenna, you'll see the antenna pattern, and you'll see the plot that came out of it. So, when it comes, let me drop. When you're measuring an antenna pattern, it's quite different than measuring the performance of an amplifier. In the case of the performance of an amplifier, it's something that sits on the bench, and you're going between the input and the output terminal of a network analyzer, or you're using a signal signal generator into the amplifier, and you're sweeping the frequency and measuring the output on a power meter or a spectrum analyzer or whatever. On a bench, an amplifier, you've got control of the environment, and the gain plot you get and the saturation plot all make sense. In the case of a plotting of an antenna pattern, the thing that's very hard to accept is that you think you're measuring an antenna. You're measuring an antenna in a particular environment. The answer you get is the combination of the antenna pattern and the reflections from the environment. When you walk around with a field strength meter, you're down at ground level, and the main lobe of the antenna that you care about is up at some other angle above the horizon, and that's not where you're holding your field strength meter. So you're going to be getting a very different antenna plot. As you walk around your backyard and you walk near the children's swing set, the reflection of the swing set is going to give you a difference in apparent antenna pattern because you're down at the wrong elevation and getting a local reflection. And how close the object is to you, the inverse square law dictates that closer objects give you a greater perturbation. But by having a buddy of yours send you a signal over the horizon, real radio path, that's a lot easier. And still you're going to be getting some reflections from water towers and things nearby. And by duplicating the process, duplicating the experiment with guys in different directions, eventually you properly interpret those graphs and you're going to find out what the real antenna pattern is. It's a fun thing to do. You've got a lot more equipment at your disposal than you know about when you think about it hard enough, John. And I think you'll enjoy it. And when you do, please come back and tell us what worked, what didn't work, and how it all worked out. KB2, KB1, QBZ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, very good. That really answers my original question, although the other material you were giving answers where I was trying to get to. So that's great. Thank you. I was thinking of using one of those field strength meters, but I see that won't do me what I want to do. Thank you very much. Back to you. This is KB1QBZ.
Yeah, you've also got a problem of dynamic range, as I see it, John. In the case of your S meter of your receiver, no matter how nonlinear it is, you can calibrate it, and you can crank that back out, if you know what I mean. Who cares if the S meter is very liberal at the low end and very scotch at the high end? Doesn't matter because you're calibrating it. And the receiver has a tremendous dynamic range. 60 dB over S9 is the right-hand side of the S meter. The S meter, S9, 69954, if the S meter was properly calibrated, is 54 dB between 0 and S9, another 60 dB between that and 60 over, you've got almost 100 decibels of dynamic range on a good signal strength meter on your receiver before you start using a step attenuator at the front end. And if the weak portions you plug in a preamplifier and the strong portions you plug in a step attenuator, there's ways that you can shift gears, so to speak, to measure the front-to-back ratio and the front-to-side ratio. You could get more than 100 dB of dynamic range by properly using your receiver with calibration. A field strength meter that when you buy them that are passive, rarely do they have more than about 20 dB of dynamic range. If the field strength meter was a complete receiver, so your receiver, between the antenna port and that loudspeaker, or between the antenna port and the S meter, so to speak, there's about 120 decibels of gain in that receiver that you're using. The one you're listening to me with right now, there's a lot of gain in that machine. No field strength meter has got anywhere near that amount of gain or anywhere near that amount of dynamic range. So that there's a number of reasons why you're not going to get quite as good an answer with the field strength meter. You'll get a rough answer. You'll find out that, yeah, the main lobe is in this direction, and maybe there's a back lobe in that direction. But because of the altitude, dynamic range, local reflections, It's not quite the answer you're looking for, in my opinion. Any further comments? Back to you, John. K2RIW in the TechNet.
I wasn't thinking in terms of mapping it, although that would come later, as much as initially just being able to tell when I've got the antenna properly tuned. But I'm hearing what you're saying about the field strength meter not necessarily giving a good indication because of the takeoff angles and such. So I think I've got a very good answer, and the answer is that I can do that testing with someone else, but that a typical field strength meter is not necessarily going to give me what it is, give me a good indication of when I have the antenna tuned, and that's what I'm really looking for. Back to you. This is KB1QBZ.
Now, when you said antenna tune, there's about three different things you could be addressing here, John. Are you talking about tuning the driven element so that the standing wave ratio is low? That's one kind of tuning. Are you talking about tuning the lengths and positions of the directors of a Yagi in order to improve its gain characteristics? Which kind of tuning are you referring to here, John? Go ahead.
The first one, the basic, getting my dipole so that it's really good at putting out a, for want of a better term, putting out a strong signal, which, you know, as you've said many times, SWR doesn't necessarily tell me that, especially if I've got a multiband antenna. Back to you.
Well, hold on now. Let's talk about a Yagi antenna. What is a Yagi? A Yagi is a bunch of directors where each individual director has a certain resonant frequency on each one of the bands you care about and a certain position in space. That's what your parasitic elements are. The parasitic element positions and tunings, directors and reflectors, that's where the antenna pattern of a Yagi antenna comes from. The directors and reflectors, their tuning and their positions. The driven element of the Yagi, its only purpose in life is to present a good standing wave ratio, to your transmitter, and to radiate in a dipole-like manner so it lights up all those parasitic elements. That's all the driven element is supposed to do. Radiate like a dipole, give you a good impedance match. Whether or not it gives you a good impedance match, your standing wave ratio bridge, your VISWR detecting equipment, or your bird watt meter in the forward and reverse mode, that's going to tell you whether or not the driven element is tuned. Tuning the driven element does not change the pattern of a Yagi. So, pattern is one thing. That's the design of the antenna. Tuning it so that maximum power goes into it is something you can measure from the shack. There are people who think you're going to get a better tuning by tuning for maximum signal into a field strength meter. Good common sense. I've been there. Not true. You'll find out that if you're pouring 100 watts into your feed line, and the antenna has a good, let me drop, the antenna has a good standing wave ratio, so that 99 watts is radiated and only 1 watt is reflected, and you know you're getting 99% of the performance out of the antenna, and no field strength meter is going to tell you anything where near as accurate as what your standing wave ratio bridge says. So there's two separate portions of the problem. Pattern is the design of the antenna. VISWR is the way you feed the driven element. And the way you feed the driven element does not change the pattern. It's not common sense, I know. Been there, done that, and so you sort of want to divide and conquer here. Pattern is what you're going to measure with your buddies and the field strength meter and rotating the antenna. And tuning is something you're going to measure with the standing wave ratio indications you've got in the shack. I wonder if that makes a little more sense here, John. KB1 QBZ, K2RIW.
This is KB1 QBZ. It does make sense, or as I'm discovering. My main issue was I've had problems in the past with built-in antenna tuners within rigs telling me that they've tuned antennas and they haven't, and I'm not getting any signal out. So I wanted to see, I'm trying to get towards finding something that'll tell me if I'm really getting a good signal out, as opposed to just looking at an SWR meter reading, which I found sometimes is misleading, especially if it's a built-in SWR meter. Back to you. This is KB1 QBZ.
I hear where you're coming from. And there may be a simpler solution for this one, John. borrow somebody's bird watt meter, borrow somebody's standing wave ratio bridge, borrow any piece of auxiliary test equipment that you install in the transmission line downrange from your tuner or your automatic tuner. An auxiliary external piece of test equipment that tells you how much power is going forward and how much power is coming back into your transmission line. That's what counts. So instrumentation that you put there is going to tell you what you want to know. And even if you think you can't afford another bird watt meter, or you don't want to borrow somebody's, or you don't own a standing wave ratio bridge, it isn't very difficult to go to the right chapter of the antenna handbook, ARL antenna handbook, and build yourself a directional coupler. You can build a homebrew directional coupler by doing nothing more than taking a piece of enameled wire, snaking it under the braid of a piece of RG8U coax cable, which is installed in a box, and putting detectors on it, you can make a directional coupler out of it, and you can find out how much power is going forward and how much power is going reverse, and that's about $10 worth of hardware to do that, if you know what I mean. And you can even put a meter on it if you like. So you can make your own homebrew directional coupler. And by the way, the insertion loss of that directional coupler will be so small, you can't measure it. But yet it tells you that real power is coming out of your transmitter with that antenna tuner. So with that auxiliary piece of the test equipment, you'll know how much power is going up that feed line, and maybe that's what you want to know. Back to you, John, K2RIW.
That does sound like what I want to know, yeah. So if I just put an SWR meter in the feed line but still in the shack, is that sufficient, or do I need it back out towards the antenna?
In the shack is going to tell you essentially everything you want to know, John. When you put power into good transmission line, assuming the transmission line doesn't have, you know, a whole lot of water in it, a whole lot of loss downrange that you don't know about, assuming it's reasonable quality transmission line, and you put 100 watts into it, there is nothing that transmission line can do but deliver it to the antenna, and if the antenna driven element is mistuned, maybe a certain amount of that power will reflect back down to you in the shack. There are lots of guys who think the only way you really know what's going on at the antenna is to put the instrumentation at the antenna, remote reading instrumentation. Good common sense. Not true. As long as you've got those connectors properly installed on that cable, and as long as there isn't a gallon of water in that cable, it can't do anything with the 100 watts you put into it but deliver it to the antenna. You don't have to be at the antenna to know that that took place. It's a given. That's all a transmission line is capable of doing, delivering the power to the antenna. And if the antenna is properly tuned, it's got to absorb that power. So 99% of the time, if you're smart enough, all the measurements can be made in the shack, and I think they do not have to be measured at the antenna. Now, you say those exact same words on the 20-meter band on Saturday afternoon, you'll get a lot of people with a different philosophy of life who don't quite understand the physics, and they'll tell you if you don't make the measurement at the antenna, that everything's going to lie to you. In extreme cases of high standing wave ratio on a transmission line, maybe they're right, but I don't think that's where you are. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
All right, Dick, thank you. I think you've answered my question enough. I don't want to tie up the rest of the net, but you've certainly given me a good basic here for getting done what I want to get done, which is measuring whether or not I'm really getting power out to the antenna. And I thank you. This is KB1QBZ.
Very fine, John. As you proceed downrange and you make these measurements and you have either success or failure with what you're doing, please come back and let us know how it worked out. There are people listening to you and I right now, and they'd like to hear the rest of the story. And you're on an interesting science experiment as I see it. Eugene, W2EWK, what's new in your neighborhood? K2RIW.
Okay, Dick, very good. This is W2EWK. On the QST magazine, on the space shuttle, okay, the Chinese satellite is on the I can't even pronounce the word. H-O-R-I-Z-O-N, Horizon, okay? on page 98 of this QST magazine of this month. It's in there if you want to read about it. QSO?
Okay. So I think you're saying the Horizon spacecraft is on page 98 of the latest issue of QST, and maybe that's the April issue. I'm not sure now. You're talking about the March or the April issue. And do you have a further question on that, Eugene, or are you telling me that this is an exciting article and I should make sure I don't miss it? Back to you, Eugene.
Yes, Dick, I was saying to you, do not miss that. Make sure you read that portion of the QST. I was very surprised when I seen it, so I want to bring it to your attention. And another thing there, Dick, I fixed the satellite antenna on my car. It was broken, and I saw the wires. The wires are very, very fine. So I bought another one, in case something did happen to it. And sure enough, something did happen to it. It broke. After I fixed it, I photographed it. Then after I photographed it, it broke. So I just took it, I put it into the garbage can, and that was it. But my friend gave me another one, so I fixed that where it was staying inside the window, and look outside the window, in which I receive all my stations. Okay, right back to you there, Dick, W2EWK.
Yeah, I think you're doing automobile reception of satellite audio. I think it's called the Sirius network, or XM. And so I guess you're saying those antennas are kind of delicate. We've got to treat them very carefully. And you found a way of fixing the fine wires and epoxying them. Do you think more than one brand is a very delicate antenna? And what do you believe caused that damage in the first place, Eugene? Go ahead.
Okay, the door damaged the wire was going out to the antenna, from the satellite radio to the roof of my car. So I fixed it, and I photographed it. It still broke. So I just took it, chucked it into the garbage. I got another antenna, hooked that antenna up, but now the antenna's not on the roof. I put it inside the car by the window, and I put double-edged tape on it, so everything is working out okay. So there's no antenna going up to the roof of the car. Everything is happy dory. QSL?
Yeah, that's interesting to know. I guess you put the antenna by the rear deck window, the rear window of the car. And I guess you're saying the antenna is now looking through that glass and still giving you pretty good satellite reception. Is that what you're saying, Eugene? Go ahead.
Yes, Dick, but only difference is I put the antenna in front of the car, the front window, QSL.
Okay, so you stuck it on the dashboard with double-sided tape looking through the front windshield, and therefore you got a short piece of wire between there and the radio that's probably on the dashboard. And now since the wiring is all inside, the dog doesn't get a chance to disturb that wiring. I think that's what you're saying. Is that true, Eugene?
Yes, Dick, but I'm not using the original antenna. I bought another antenna, which now I am using, and the first antenna is DOA, Dead on Arrival. I threw that antenna away because it broke the second time. So now I'm using a new antenna. Now everything is happy-dory because everything is in the car. QSL, W2EWK.
Yeah, pretty good. And I guess you're saying that these satellite receivers are not too sensitive as to what brand name of antenna. So the new antenna maybe is a different brand. Where did you buy it, and how much did that antenna cost? Over to you, Eugene.
Okay there, Dick. The antenna is... I didn't purchase it. My friend gave me another one just like it, the same model, make the model. He owns a stereo store. He gave it to me for free, F-R-E-E, and I put it inside the window. So everything is okay now there, Dick. And I was very surprised. I fixed it. It was working like a charm. And to that fiberglass was going back and forth. So now it's DOA.